Welcome to the R7 Christian Marketing Podcast, sponsored by Emma's Good.
R7 is an innovative, God-inspiring process that explores personal and professional purpose. R7 analyzes seven strategies to transform your vision and find direction in your organizational marketing. R7 establishes clarity and guidance for the gift we call life. This is my destiny.
Welcome to the R7 Podcast, man. My heart is actually like beating hard. Like I'm so excited about having this somatic experience right now. My palms are sweaty. I'm so excited about Dr. Phil Cook joining us today on the podcast. Like, I don't know what I've done, Phil, to arrive at this point, but something must be good.
You must be living right, Dave. You must be living right.
For those of you who don't know, Phil is he is a legend in the Christian media space, doctor, producer, philosopher, board member. I mean, you've been with every major ministry over the past. This is going to make you sound a little bit older than most of us.
But, oh, yeah.
I hate to say it, okay. But like the last three decades, man, like it's not even one or two, it's three decades.
Yeah. Well, the fact is, if you live as long as I have, you meet people and you start working with people. So we've had the opportunity and the honor in many ways of consulting and advising and coaching many of the largest ministries in the country, particularly those focused on media, because that's our wheelhouse. My background's a producer, television producer. And so we've shot film footage in about 70 countries around the world. And we've done Super Bowl commercials and TV specials, all kinds of things. But our real focus is helping Christians. We jokingly say, Dave, our focus is helping Christians not suck at the media.
Yeah.
And there's much work to be done there. I have to say, as you know very, very well, very often we get the message right. But how we share that message could be so much better and more effective. So that's kind of the target market that we shoot for, is churches and ministries that want to make an impact. After all, media is the language of today's culture. And if we don't get that and learn how to use it well, we'll lose this generation. So we're pretty passionate about that, as you can tell.
Yeah. Like if you're just beginning in this space, Christian media space, Phil Cook is just an incredible resource. 12 books. You've hit the subject of Christian media in how many different ways? Like, I got this book here right in front of me. I've read this so many times. I was looking back on this, Phil. I ripped the cover off it. There's no cover on it.
That's a classic. That's the first one. Yeah.
Wow.
You're very kind.
So let's talk about that first. Then talk about pain points, and I do want to, from your perspective, but also from the ministry perspective. But I really kind of, looking back in all the books, and I know we've been in meetings, we've done a couple maybe projects here or tried to do some projects here. And I know you put everything into whatever you do. Like, you are like the epitome of first class and like quality. Like, when you think about the books you've written, which one like really stands out of, this is the one I moved the dial on?
You know, it's interesting. Every time I write a book, as soon as it's published, I realize, man, I'd go back and change a lot of that. But there's been a couple interesting books. My book, One Big Thing, Discovering What You Were Born to Do, I wrote, really, you could follow a journey in my books. I started, like you're saying, I started with branding faith, why some churches impact culture and others don't. And I really started the conversation about branding in the church setting before most people really understood it. And so I got a lot of criticism back in those days. And now people really get it. I find that pastors, leaders, companies, particularly like yours, you're getting, you know, you've been into this in a deep, deep way, and you're quite brilliant at it. And so people are starting to understand. And so I updated my book, Branding Faith, to a book called Unique, Telling Your Story in the Age of Brands and Social Media. When social media came on the scene, it pretty much changed a lot of stuff. It changed everything. So we have to rethink now, what is our brand in the context of social media too? And so it's just been one thing after another. And then I wrote the book, One Big Thing, Discovering What You Were Born to Do. And it became one of the top 10 business books the year it was published. And that was really because the thing I discovered about branding when it comes to organizations also works in many ways when it comes to us, you know, standing out, being known for something, being unique and different. All those things can apply to us. I find, you know, it's funny. You probably met people that will say, you know, Dave, I'm pretty good at a lot of things, but I don't know of a single thing I'm really, really good at. Mm-hmm. And I know guys that have that are in their 70s and 80s who will tell me, you know, I've made a living. I've been pretty good, you know, at a lot of stuff, but I really don't know what God put me on the earth to accomplish. And I think that's so sad to not know what you were really wired to do. And so I put that all into one big thing, and it's been really, really well received out there. And so I just kind of went from there, and it's funny. I wrote the book Ideas on a Deadline, about how to be creative when you're under pressure. That's so important. It's one thing to be creative. It's another, like you and I, we have deadlines. We live by deadlines. And like mm-hmm. I said, I produce Super Bowl commercials, and I discovered pretty early that the Super Bowl is not going to change their date because I don't come up with a kind of, I can't come up with a funny commercial.
Yeah.
And so we've lived, I mean, broadcast television is my whole life. And so I've learned to be creative under pressure. So I wrote that book for people that struggle with that. And most recently I've written, my book, really, I think it's, I got a lot of calls early in my career about helping churches and ministry organizations go through a crisis. And so I discovered early on, I'm not the attorney, I'm not the counselor, but their problem was communication. No matter what the problem was to begin with, if you don't communicate it well to your church, your congregation, the general public, to the media, it gets worse and worse and worse. So I wrote the book Church on Trial, How to Protect mm-hmm. Your Congregation, Mission, and Reputation During a Crisis, out of years and years and years of helping a ton of churches really navigate a crisis situation. So I don't mean to preach here, but you know, the one book leads to another, which leads to another. And I've got a couple more in the pipeline. So we'll see how that goes.
I feel like I got my third book coming out.
That's awesome.
So it's going to be Plan to Win, How to Navigate Your Fear, Lust, Anger, Pride While Building Your Christian Organization.
Oh, that's great.
So I've kind of like, that's why I kind of want to, just kind of a testing ground here in December. It's going to come out in June. But, you know, when you look at what holds that Christian entrepreneur back, you know, I've kind of looked at it from an emotion perspective, your fear, yeah. your lust, your anger, and your pride. And so lust, we think of sexual lust, but I've kind of turned it a little bit in the book and talked about like lust for possessions or lust for a bigger building or lust for, you know, that's a lustful kind of thing. Like
yeah.
if I build this amount of money, I will be this much better than the lust for something bigger. And so it kind of reshaped that. But what do you think when you're talking about that Christian, let's just kind of look at the Christian entrepreneur has this vision from the Lord that wants to communicate it to the world. What do you think is the pain point of that? What holds them back? What do you think?
You know, the word that stuck out for me when you were reading the title is pride. And we don't think of it overtly as pride so much, but we do. I'll tell you what, I think I tell people, I think one of the reasons, despite how many years I've been doing this, one of the reasons God is constantly dangling me over the precipice of financial disaster is because I worry that if I got really well off financially, I would get a little bit prideful. And I think many, many people are that way. It's so easy to get caught up in, hey, I did this. I built this. This is my dream. And I think staying humble is a really, really critical thing. The more I read, I'm going through the Old Testament right now and reading about the Old Testament kings and how they wandered off. And it's like every other one did not follow God. And part of the reason was they got prideful. They were pretty impressed with themselves. And so I think very often I've seen Christian entrepreneurs fail and Christian leaders fail because they start believing their press and they start believing in themselves. And so I don't know. For me, pride is always out there in front. I just really want to stay as humble as possible. And I never want to get to the point where I'm proud of my humility, but I really want to be keep that perspective in mind. I think it's important.
That's so good. Be prideful of my humility. And so like being around some of the most influential Christian people in the world, like yeah. you have to see the pride. Right.
You have to
see like that's running this whole thing. And like, how do you navigate that?
Well,
I'm sure you got some stories, man. I have some stories.
I'm going to wait. You know, as I get closer to the end of my life, I'll write the book, and then I'll go to each one of those guys and tell them to pay me not to publish it. I think that's going to be the secret. That's how I'm going to make a lot of money. No. You know, my philosophy has always been that God is bigger. You know, a lot of people ask me why I'm not cynical, because I have worked with some real jerks over the years. Yeah. And there are the vast majority of people we've worked with have been incredible, just wonderful people that I value enormously. But we've occasionally come across that occasional jerk. And my philosophy has always been God is bigger than whatever bonehead happens to be representing him at a given time. And so I've never gotten cynical. It's never bothered me. That's just human nature. Probably the question is, why don't more of us go down that road? Because that's a very common, we are all fallen creatures. So it doesn't excuse it by any means, but it does explain why it doesn't, you know, I see so many people that walk away from God and talk about, you know, my church hurt me. My church, you know, didn't appreciate me. Well, it wasn't the church that hurt you. It was some jerk that was in church. Yeah. Maybe a couple or two or three people that were, you know, that treated you badly. Well, let's evaluate that. It's really not the church. And so, I haven't found an organization, by the way, in the world where there's not a few jerks involved. Political parties, you know, college dorm fraternities, the local Elks Club, whatever you want, there's going to be some jerks involved. So understand, we're all human beings, and there's going to be a bad apple here and there. Learn to navigate that. In fact, you know, as you would probably agree, I think this here, I'm wandering all over the map, but I think people skills, this is for young entrepreneurs out there, I think people skills are more important than the skill it takes to do your job. 100%. Being able to inspire and motivate the people around you is so much more critical than being the best electrician in town, the best preacher in town, the best writer in town, whatever it is you do. Being able to get along and motivate and inspire people is really absolutely critical.
That's so good. I think that I just had this conversation like 2 hours ago. So we get 1 to 2 leads from all around the world. And it, you know, we own the search term Christian marketing. Wow. Like we've been number one there for years. I'm so thankful and humbled that we just get leads that just come in. And so I would say 1 to 2 each week. And I personally filter through all of them. So I could probably write a book or do a whole podcast on like on a Shark Tank for Christians, because I get some really dumb ideas that come through.
Oh, I bet.
They're so dumb. And early on in my career, Phil, I was like, you know, this is probably a bad idea and you're going to get slaughtered mentally, emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And I'd tell him that, like, you know, you need to go back to God. Like, this isn't it.
Yep.
And I have kind of matured out of that. And I say, you know what? This is what they feel God has given to them. I want to help you. And I'm not going to judge you by your budget, which some agencies do. I don't even know. I've been in this bubble for 25 years. I don't really know what else is out there, but you know, I want to look at what is your vision? How can we explore you glorifying that vision to the world? And so let's find the tip of the spear in your messaging. Let's go down the path. It's going to cost a little money. I'll do the best that I can to kind of make that a minimal investment. Still, we got to, you know, pay for things, but you know, let's go through this process and like, let's do it. And I think honestly, that has kept me humble in the space of want to be usable by God. That hit me years ago. Like there's somebody was singing a song like use me God. And I was like, am I usable? I don't know. Like I need to be usable here, you know? And so I think that one, you know, part of what I do throughout the week has just kept me humble in that. And
that's good. That's a good lesson actually.
Yeah. And I just don't judge other bigger ministries. You know, I just say, hey, that's their walk. That's not my walk. That's their walk. And I got to protect my mental, emotional, and physical, spiritual space.
That's a great word. You know, a number of years ago, we met with a woman in Atlanta. Her name was Ann White, and she had a ministry and a little bitty ministry, tiny ministry. She taught the Bible to at-risk women. So she had a team of chaplains in the Atlanta prison system working with women prisoners throughout the city. And I met with her, and she wanted us to help maybe rebrand her ministry and help her do a few videos to promote it, help her kind of grow the ministry. And I didn't want to do it, frankly. I just thought, okay, she's too small. She's not going to have the budget we need. I didn't want to do it. And my wife, Kathleen, argued for it. And she pushed me and she said, no, honey, you need to do this. Do it. Let's go talk to her. So we did. We went in and we rebranded her ministry, changed the name of the ministry, really made a big impact in what she was doing. And I learned through the process that she's one of the most prolific writers I've ever seen. She writes like crazy. She'd written multiple books. Now, then we got this, one thing led to another and we decided, you know what? We need to print a Bible with her notes in it because she's so prolific. She's got so many Bible teaching notes. And then we realized at-risk women, if you're running from an abusive husband and you're in a women's shelter or you're in jail somewhere, you don't want to be carrying around a big old study Bible. So I said, you know what? Okay, let's find a Bible app that would work that these women could put on their phone or their digital tablet, whatever. So then we discovered that, hey, if you've been beaten up by a guy for the last 10 years, the last thing in the world you want is to hear the Bible read in a man's voice. So I thought, fine, we'll find a Bible app that's read by women. And there was none out there, absolutely none. So we did it. We produced the first audio Bible in history recorded entirely in women's voices. And oh man, it just went nuts. I think today it's on like 100,000 digital tablets and prisons all over America. And we discovered even male prisoners like it because in many cases they were beaten up by their dad growing up and they love to hear a woman's voice. So very often what looks like is too small to mess with, they won't have the budget. Boy, we got in there and now today she's done a print version of the Bible that Zondervan has released and it's gone nuclear. It's sold like crazy. And so very often the organization, the person, the ministry that you want to invest that you see doesn't have any potential. You just never know where God's going to take that. So I think just what you're talking about is a great lesson for everybody.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know that, you know, when I think about performance.
Yep.
And money, like, I just don't think God cares.
Well, okay, so let me counter that. Let's have a little healthy argument. Let's have a healthy argument. Yeah. So in my case, I'm primarily a video producer. We produce promotional videos, all kind of fundraising videos, a lot of that stuff. Now we help with branding and helping, you know, communications of all kind within a ministry. However, we produce videos. So I kind of, at one point, I met so many people who were struggling in their ministry or their church. I finally realized, look, I'm going to create price to use as a benchmark. So I started saying, because I realized I met with our team and we all agreed that, look, if they don't have a certain amount of money, sure, we're flexible. We've worked with ministry budgets, you know, for decades. We're really flexible. But at a certain point, if you can't do it well enough to be proud of, it may not be worth doing. So we started using money. It sounds crass maybe, but we started using money as a benchmark to find out, hey, are these guys really serious? Do they want to move forward? And are they willing to go out and try to raise the money to make it happen? And it's been quite interesting. And so, I'm both ways. I'm not all about money, but we do our best to try to find ministries we can work with that, you know, we're more interested in the end result.
Okay. So we're talking about money and we're talking about a benchmark. And I totally get that to do it right, you got to have a benchmark and you got to have, like, trust me, I like money. I don't, you know, worship the love of money.
And my problem is I don't have any. That's the problem.
I get that. I just think from a at the end of the day, when working with clients and kind of looking at the vision, like, I'm not going to care about that. Like, what are you giving and what do you love to get involved in is more important than making a dollar. And we do have to make a dollar and I do have payroll and I have some numbers I got to hit every month, you know? So I'm all about it, but, you know,
well, you know, honestly, I think God gives us certain bigger clients to help. So we're able to do the smaller clients that can't afford a lot. I remember in the old days, remember Billy Graham, they did movies back in the 70s and 80s. They were producing movies and they weren't great. They weren't great movies, but he was a real pioneer in trying to get movies out there in the marketplace, Christian movies. But he couldn't raise money for Christian movies. Nobody wanted to give. And so he would raise money in other areas, you know, in other areas of his ministry and put some of that money into making films. And some of those films had a big impact. So like The Hiding Place, for instance, and So yeah, very often we have to find a client that is a really great client. And that helps us do the projects that we really are passionate about over here that we don't have the budget for.
Amen. Let's shift gears a little bit.
Okay.
And I know you're an expert in this area. I kind of have an idea how to do this, but I want to talk to you about how do you get your voice above the noise? It seems like every year the massive impressions that we have, and I've got a little story I'd like to share with you actually.
Please.
That I use a lot. So I'd love to use it for you to punch holes in this. So back in 1980, when Ronald Reagan was president, the amount of gross impressions were right around 600 to 1,000 per day. So the average American is getting hit with, you know, for companies to buy their toilet paper, toothpaste, mouthwash, deodorant, cat food, whatever. So 600 to 1,000 impressions. The bounce rate was 30 days. So when the president gave a speech, that speech would resonate with the American people for 30 days. If we fast forward to when Obama was elected, the gross impressions are up to about 9,000 a day.
Yep.
The bounce rate is up to 2 days. Fast forward to Donald Trump's, like now, in fact, we're in fourth quarter. So it's right around 17 to 22,000 impressions a day.
Yep.
And our bounce rate's about an hour.
And that so if makes you, perfect sense.
Yeah. So if you look at the data, it's like, okay, I don't have a big budget, but how do I now find the tip of the spear in my messaging and rise above the noise? I mean, you've written 3 books on this.
Yeah.
What do you say?
Well, that's an interesting statistic. And I'll tell you something to add to that is the compression has happened really quickly in the span of, say, our grandparents or great grandparents, that amount of time. In fact, if you read 7 days of a daily newspaper, now I know most people watching or listening to this podcast aren't reading newspapers anymore, but if you would read 7 days of a daily newspaper, you've read more information than the typical person just 100 years ago read during their entire lifetime. So you go from that to the amount of information we're consuming today, it's actually staggering, just absolutely staggering. In fact, one book called Abundance that came out a few years ago said, a Maasai warrior in the heart of the African bush with a cell phone, and trust me, they have them because I've filmed them, has access now to more information than the president of the United States did just 25 years ago. So what's interesting to me is we're being hit with so much information, so much clutter, that it's completely changed our behavior. So you probably know that the Wall Street Journal did a study a few years ago that indicates that because we're so distracted, we've got text messages to answer, our phone's ringing. We got so many things to do that it's changed our behavior. So then when we meet somebody for the first time, we decide what we think of that person in the first 4 to 8 seconds.
Wow.
So think about that. You haven't had time to meet them, talk with them, find out anything about them, but hey, I got things to do, man. I got text messages to answer. I got emails to respond to. So we've decided we make decisions about things that we don't even know what they are. And I've discovered that's also true with products and experiences. So I tell pastors all the time that I'm glad your sermon's anointed. I'm glad your worship experience is fantastic. But in an 8-second world, what's your parking experience like? What's your lobby look like? Who's the first person a new visitor meets when they walk in the door? Because we happen to live in a culture today where I can pretty much guarantee you 90 to 99% of the people that come in will decide what they think of your church before they ever get to their chair. So that just happens to be the world we live in. So that's the context I would let everybody know about, because it's not the person that has the best message anymore. Mm. It's the person that has the message that cuts through that clutter and knows how to cut through that clutter. And I think that's the most critical thing we have to think about, because, and particularly the iPhone has made it worse. I think the last study I saw just a few months ago indicated we're now touching our phones 2,397 times a day.
Oh my God.
And I'll tell you what's funny is if you go on YouTube, and listeners and viewers, don't do this until the podcast's over, but go on YouTube and you can find videos of people that are so obsessed with their phone. They walk into signs, they walk into buildings, they walk into fountains, they get hit by cars. I was filming in Berlin a few years ago, and we're standing there filming in downtown Berlin, and we were watching a guy in a business suit who is so obsessed with his phone, he walks right into a canal. I mean, right into a canal. And that's the world we live in today. In fact, I've heard that some cities in Europe are experimenting with padded utility poles. And let me go further.
Oh, gosh.
I heard that New Jersey and Hawaii, the legislatures are discussing outlawing texting while walking. It's become such a problem. So that's the world we live in, which is the world, not the world our parents or our grandparents live in. And everything has changed. And I think the point you bring up is absolutely critical. If we don't know how to cut through that clutter, we're never going to get heard.
All right. So you said something so incredibly powerful there, right? It's not the best message.
Yeah.
It's the message that cuts through the clutter.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So this is why I like the TikTok is going crazy.
Yeah.
It's the dumbest videos. It's cutting through the clutter.
Yeah. I will die before videos. I explain TikTok. I'll tell you that.
It's the AI dog videos.
Yeah.
It's cutting through the clutter. So now how do you take your strategic vision and put it in a juxtaposition ad that's fun and cutting through? That's a whole nother.
Well, you're a marketing genius.
That's a whole nother level, man.
You're the marketing genius, but I can tell you some of the principles that we use. And yeah. One is really discovering your one big thing. I've discovered you can't be all things to all people. So let's focus on what you're amazing at doing. And it's interesting that if you're a leader of an organization, what does your organization do better than anybody else on the planet? And if you're a person, you know, if you're thinking about your own personal brand or your own personal, how you navigate the world, what's the thing you do better than others? I often liken it to the prom. Remember your high school prom where you were on the prom committee and you sat around a table saying, you know, Bob, you're amazing with numbers. Why don't you do the budget? And Susan, you're fantastic with people. Why don't you host it? John, you're super creative, man. Why don't you come up with a theme and a title? People notice what we're really good at long before we do very often. And so I think that figuring out what that thing is you're amazing at doing is the place to start, whether it's you personally or your church, your ministry, your organization, whatever. And because you want something that separate, you know, one of the funny things is the woman, she may have lost her title by now, but the woman forever that's had the most Grammy Awards in history is not Aretha Franklin. It's not Celine Dion. It's not all the big popular singers of today. The woman who has the most Grammy Awards in history is Alison Krauss, the bluegrass player. And it's because she so dominates that niche of hers, that small, narrow space. She's so amazing that every year in the Grammys, she walks away with all the awards from that category. So she's become so famous because of that, that now she's done a classical album with, I think, Yo-Yo Ma. She's done a rock album with Robert Plant from Led Zeppelin. She can do anything she wants because being the master of her niche is what put her on the map. So a friend of mine, Scott Derrickson, as a film director in Hollywood, and he decided to make his niche horror movies. And he's a Christian guy who has a whole theology of why Christians should do horror movies. That's another podcast. We'll schedule that sometime. But because he became so amazing at doing horror that one year, a number of years ago, his film was the most successful horror movie out there. And guess what? Marvel gave him Doctor Strange to do. So he went from relatively low budget horror movies to $200 million movie, all because he became so well known because he was just amazing at that narrow space. So number one, find out what you're amazing at doing and focus on that message. I think that's the key to cutting through a lot of that clutter and getting on the radar.
All right. So let me just recap what you said.
Yeah.
Being the best version of yourself in a very specific category rises above the noise.
Absolutely. Now there's some other things to do. There's ways to do it, you know, and we can go into that, but I think you start with what is it you do better than anybody else? What are you absolutely amazing at? I'll give you a good example. My pastor for many years when we lived in LA was Jack Hayford. You know, I think Jack Hayford is like the Protestant Pope. He was just amazing. We our family went there for 20 some years. And I've heard Jack preach messages on everything under the sun. But the interesting thing about Jack, he just didn't preach at our church. He led worship. He was a horrible singer, but he was a brilliant worship leader. And he's written 5 books on worship. He's written 100 worship songs. So if you cut Jack, He bleeds worship, man. That everything was focused on that. That's the lens he looked at everything through. So no matter what he preached on, it could be revelation, it could be salvation, it could be finances, it could be family. Whatever he preached on, he did it through the lens of worship. And that's what elevated Jack above so many pastors out there and what made him so desirable. So many people wanted him to speak at their conference, their events. He just knew what he was brilliant at doing because it was what he lived and breathed. And so finding that thing that you're the best in the world at is, I think, the place to start. Does that make sense?
I love this because I have this story too, that it always resonates with people. So years ago, we had a 17,000 square foot facility and we basically built it all out. And my VP had a glass wall. Okay. So it was a glass looking out over the parking lot, and over the parking lot was the parking lot, but it was also a pond. Okay. And there were all these different birds that would gather. And this particular, you actually met Jason years ago. So Jason was a bird watcher. He loved birds, and he could tell you any type of bird that was flying throughout the year. Him and his dad used to go to the migration up in New Jersey somewhere, and they would write down how many birds, different species of birds they could see. So anyway, we're sitting there, and there's like these birds that are pecking on the ground, and Phil, there's this one bird that was like gangly looking. It almost looked sick, and it was pecking on the ground. And I was like, Jason, what is that? He said, that's an eaglet. It doesn't know its purpose yet. When it does, it'll fly majestically over lakes and, you know, in the ocean and just pull out, you know, whatever it wants out of the lake or the ocean. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is so good. Yeah. So like when I think about that story, I think about, the bird doesn't look to the dog or the alligator and say, I wish I was a dog or an alligator. The bird just does what it's God created it to do, and it glorifies the Lord. It doesn't have to say, open up the Bible. It just does what it was designed to do. And I think about that as humans. Like, if we do what we were designed to do, right, that's cuts above the noise. There's always space for your passion and what you're called to do.
I love that. I love that. And then the thing is, you know, suddenly I'll give you a good example. I tell young directors who are coming to Hollywood, don't come to Hollywood to be the best director, because if you do, you're going to compete against Scorsese and Steven Spielberg and James Cameron and Quentin Tarantino. You're going to compete get some heavy hitters.
Right.
Come out to be the best at a certain style, a certain budget level, a certain genre. Mm. Find that niche that, like Scott did, find that niche. His was horror. Maybe yours is romantic comedies, or maybe yours is super low budget or something else. I have a friend that makes films on iPhones, and she's amazing at it. And she's really, really good. And she gets her films distributed on major platforms. Finding that niche that makes you unique and different, that's when you start to get noticed, because you suddenly you're not competing against everybody. You're competing against a very small group of people, and that makes all the difference.
Okay. So I want to ask you how you deal with this. I won't say the ministry, but some people could probably figure it out. I was in a meeting years ago with a pastor who happens to lead or be part of some of the best worship music ever written all time. Okay.
Yep.
So it's a worship ministry. And if I said the name, you'd know, but I kind of want to leave that off.
Okay.
And he says, I want to be known as the best teaching pastor. And I just went, I'm like, oh, how do I deal with it? How do I respond to this? So clearly he's taken the wrong, like the path is just not the path of what they were branded to be.
Yeah.
Like, what do you say to that? How do you push back on that? Do you?
You know what?
Okay, let's go do that.
Well, sometimes I do. On the other hand, I don't want to crash their dream.
Right.
So what I'll often do is say, great, let's focus on that. And over the course of the work that we do with them, kind of, you know, move the needle a little bit and kind of turn the ship in the direction it needs to go. For instance, a teaching pastor, great. That's one thing about a brand or a perception. It's not really what we say it is. It's what they say it is. It's what the audience or the customer says it is. So, you know, okay, if you want to be a great teaching pastor, let's see if you can become known for that. But in the meantime, let's focus on what you're known for right now, which is worship. And I think you've got a great point. But, you know, so often we don't just look around us and see what people think of us right now. I love asking people, okay, what do you think of when you think of me? Or what do you think of when you think of our company? I think there have been times in our company's history, Cook Media Group, that I didn't really do a good job of recognizing what people looked at us for. And I tried to be something else and I was able to right the ship. And so I think that we just need to be aware of, you know, and whenever I'm doing a branding session with people, I always say, you know, the simple way to put it is, what do people think of when they think of you? What is that perception they have? We can shape it. We can kind of mold it a little bit, but we can't create it. That's got to be created in their mind, not ours.
Yeah.
But we can do everything we can to try to move them in that direction. And a lot of big companies out there spend a lot of money to do it, but I think there's other ways we can do it as well.
Okay, so let's just keep on going on that. We've seen, and then we'll switch gears a little bit here.
No, good.
We've seen some companies, not Christian, bobble that.
Yeah. You think about Cracker Barrel?
Cracker Barrel and Bud Light. And, you know, like.
Yeah. Coke did it at one time.
Coke did once. What was that? Classic Coke versus. Yeah.
Right. Coke, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, what's funny about Cracker Barrel is not only did they miss the mark, and I really studied that. I wrote a couple blog posts on it, and I'm about ready to release a new one. In my book, Church on Trial, about crisis communication, I talk about what many of us call the domino effect, which means if you have a problem, if you have a crisis, or like, you know, like a sexual abuse situation at your church or a financial crisis at your church, very often that opens the door for people to start looking at other things as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for instance, one church had a big crisis and suddenly people started looking at the finances and the staffing and a lot of different things. And that suddenly it's a domino issue. Suddenly a bunch of things pile up. Well, now Cracker Barrel got so much controversial press coverage and so much negative response to their that disastrous rebrand. Now people are coming back and saying, well, you know what? The food's not any good either. And the dominoes are falling. They're finding other areas about Cracker Barrel not to like. In fact, Wall Street Journal, as we record this, Wall Street Journal did a feature story on the fact that food has become a huge, they're getting a record number of complaints about their food quality. So those kind of issues can happen if you're not careful. One misstep can open the door to finding out a whole lot of other things that people otherwise wouldn't have known about. So I don't know how I got onto that, but it does interest me a lot how people.
It does interest me a lot too, because I think about if I was on the end of that, what would I have done differently? I think I would have rolled out things not as quickly. If I really wanted to turn the company, like, don't do it all at once.
Yeah.
Well, there was just I wrote a book. You're good. Sorry.
I did. People hate change. I wrote a book years ago called Jolt, and it was about how to overcome, you know, how to help people change. And one of the things I discovered, there was a study done that indicated the vast majority of open heart surgery patients within 2 years go back to their old lifestyle, smoking, drinking, eating cheeseburgers and French fries, all the stuff that got them. Forced them to have open heart surgery in the first place. People hate change so much, they're willing to risk death because they hate change. So trust me, if people are willing to risk that, the changes you're making in your sanctuary or your church or your brand or your website, we have to be very careful about how we unfold those changes, because people, I don't know what it is, just a natural thing. People hate change, and you have to be able to overcome that in any kind of effort you do creatively.
When you're working with some ministries, I mean, you're definitely on, I would say, correct me if I'm wrong, but on the more successful, been around for years side of things, right? Like, that's mostly your audience.
We've been very fortunate. A lot of people have come and gone during the time we've been out there, and maybe my day will come, but, you know, we still hang in there because I think what we do is really critical. And honestly, it goes back, I think, to people skills, helping just be able to navigate people, the ups and downs of working with people. And that's a big part of it. But no, fortunately, by the grace of God, we have been quite successful in what we've done. So I'm grateful for that.
So I kind of just want to put it in the viewer listeners' lap of, you know, as sure. Christian organizational leader who is either starting a brand or trying to turn your brand.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about that. Like, I'm starting a brand. Like, what's one or two key things that you would recommend in starting your brand?
Well, I think you have to cast a vision for it. Number one, one of the biggest reasons people hate change is because they don't realize the value that lies on the other side. They don't realize how much better things will be once we go through this painful change. And so they just think it's not worth it. So why should I even do it? And so I think number one, cast a really positive, strong vision about where you want to go and where we're going to end up and how amazing it's going to be when we do. I think another critical thing is make people part of the process. Doesn't mean they all get a voice. Doesn't mean you have to listen to everybody, but people just want to be heard. And if they start to think, hey, my pastor, my CEO, my president, he's just making changes because he wants to and not listening to us, they'll shut down pretty quickly. So I think a key thing is making your team, whether it's your, you know, staff, whether it's the congregation, help make them part of the process, because the more you can excite them and motivate them and get them behind it, the better off you'll be. Very often, I think we just fail at those things and we wonder why people don't get on board with us. And that's so critically important.
I was fortunate enough to play pro hockey. If you haven't noticed, like, my nose is like just totally like, like lopsided right here.
And I'm surprised you don't have brain damage, man. That's a tough sport.
I've had 7 concussions. My last one was really, really bad. Like today it still affects me. It was back in 15. But when I left, I played in Germany. And when I left, I always tell people, I felt like I was on a curb in a city I'd never been in.
Wow.
Like my identity was, it was an identity crisis. I didn't know who I was. I was a hockey player until I was 25. That's what I identified as. And when I left, I didn't know, feel like what I identified with. So I just went to this kind of idea of, if I put enough people down, I'll be on top.
Yes. Okay. There you go. That's an idea.
That didn't work.
It works in hockey for sure.
It works in hockey. And so, I think about identity a lot. In fact, it really kind of inspired me to keep going and get my doctorate, and like just identity and psychology, and just identifying who I am in Christ, not who I am as a person of like production or money or wealth or fame or possessions. So that's really kind of been the backbone of kind of what's motivated me. But when I think about other organizations, organizational leaders, and when you're saying casting vision, and I think about, okay, I kind of know from a vision perspective and an identity how long it takes, but you know, it's casting vision's hard, man. Collaborating is hard. And so when you think about like, how long do you really stay in that pocket, you know?
Well, it's a great question. And, you know, it reminds me of a story. Ken Wales is a movie producer in Hollywood, passed away about 10 or 15 years ago. And he was an old friend of mine. And he produced all the Pink Panther movies, and he did did Christie, the TV series. But he told me one day that he was Walt Disney's intern. He started in the business as an intern for Walt Disney. Can you imagine? Wow. And he said the interesting thing about Walt was, he always wanted to do things bigger and better. He just always had a vision for bigger and better. And so even before he finished Disneyland in LA, he already had an idea. We could do this better. We could do it bigger. And so he got his architects and designers. As soon as they did the grand opening, he got his whole team, moved them to Florida, bought the property in Orlando, and started working on bigger and better. They started doing Disney World. But a lot of people don't know, before it opened, Walt passed away. He had cancer and he passed away. And so on opening day, they were having the celebrities and the parades, and, you know, everybody was out there cutting ribbons. And Ken said Walt's widow was sitting at the stands all by herself, you know, obviously despondent because Walt wasn't there. And one of the Disney executives, one of the young guys trying to be encouraging, leaned over to her and said, you know, it's such a shame Walt can't be here to see this. And without missing a beat, she leaned back immediately and said, oh, no, you don't understand. Walt saw it. That's why it's here.
Oh, my God.
I mean, think about that.
That's Walt, so good.
Walt, is that a vision statement?
That's awesome.
Walt saw it. That's why it's here.
Yeah, so good.
That's a statement about the power of your vision, because it motivates and inspires all the people around you. Mm. And I think the greater the vision, the faster it's going to happen, quite frankly. And by the way, let me just say that also a big part of this is creating an inspired creative culture around you. One of the things many people have said now, but culture is more important than vision. You know, I'm a big vision guy. However, as you probably have, I've worked with a number of ministry leaders that had great vision, but their culture was, awful. Yeah. It was dark. People were backbiting and, getting revenge on each other and didn't like each other, didn't want to work together. And I'll tell you, I don't care how great your vision is, without a creative, vibrant culture, that vision is never going to happen. I'd rather work on a place, with a team with great without a vision, but a great creative culture, because something will come out of that. So vision and culture, they kind of work side by side in making change happen. I think that's really important.
Your book, Jolt, man, like if you haven't picked that up and talking about change, it's so good. I use this analogy and tell me what you think about it. It's called spider monkey mentality.
Okay.
So the spider monkey mentality is, it's an actual monkey. Yeah. And the way they pick them up is they put a box in the jungle, and where they, I don't know what fruit it is, but it's a fruit that they like, they put it in the box. And okay. So when they put their hand in the box, it makes a fist. So they can't let go. If they let go, they can run away, but they won't let go. So they're holding on to the fruit and they just pick them up. They just walk by and pick them up. They won't let go. And I think about that with change. Like, you have a spider monkey mentality. What are you holding on to that won't allow you to be free?
Whoa, that's good. That's really good. That's really good. Wow.
And so okay. That's kind of to me, I think about like the next step in my journey is so much bigger than what I'm holding on to.
That's really, really true. And the truth is, you do have to let go of some things.
You have to let go.
Very often in my world, the media business, young producers start out and they do everything. They write, they direct, they produce, they do the video editing. They do a little bit of everything because we have to. We have super low budgets and we're trying our best to get in the industry. But as you move up the ladder, guess what? You have to start letting go of things. You know, Steven Spielberg did a lot of stuff when he started, but today he's just a director. He's a director because he let go of those things and he's at the absolute peak of the ladder. So we have to be willing, if we're going to move up the ladder as leaders, as professionals, as creative people, we've got to start letting go of peripheral things and focus on that one big thing. What's the thing? You know, you talked about my books. One of my great regrets is that I didn't find out I could write until relatively late in life. And that was only because I didn't have the budget to hire a writer. We would do commercials and promos and television programs, and I just didn't have the budget to hire a writer. So I just started writing them myself. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I discovered, hey, I'm not terrible at this. And I really enjoyed it. And I started pouring some of that into my first book and discovered, okay, this is something I really, really like. And I don't make a lot of money from my books because they're for a niche audience. They're a really target audience. They're not, for everybody. But I would write for free. I would write if I had to pay people to be able to write. That's just what I do. And so once you've learned what your niche is, I'll tell you, like you said, suddenly it changes your perspective on everything and you
it
really
changes
focus
everything.
On
it. It really does.
It becomes amazing.
I think you have to fight the world on distraction and doing all this stuff in order to look like you're doing lots of stuff versus focusing. I think honestly with M is Good, in full transparency, like this is my 25th year.
Wow.
At year 13, I don't say this to a lot, I'm saying on the podcast today, I got bored.
Yeah.
I got bored and I said, okay, God, what do you have me do? And I just felt like going wide wasn't the answer, doing something else. I said, you know what? I need to reinvent the whole marketing idea. Let's go deep. Wow. And that'll be new to me, but I'll stay in the category of marketing. And that's really where I really just kind of looked at psychology and behavior and, cognitive behavior theory, where what we think, what we say, what we feel drives our actions. Looking at the messaging and just driving that down and saying, okay, how can I be better and better and better? And I think today, because, we've been in this space long enough, I've been through so many mistakes that I know that this won't work anymore,
Well, the lesson for people listening or watching on this episode is, be so aware of things that you stop for a minute and think about stuff like that. Had you just kept going, you'd have never stopped and realized, hey, I'm just bored to death. I remember 15 or so years into my company, Cook Media Group, I looked around. My situation was a little different in that I looked around and realized the stuff I was producing was a little old. It was a little out of date. The style wasn't as current as it should be. And I started rethinking everything. I started working with younger people. I started listening to different voices, and it transformed everything we did. And so about every 5 years, I take a hard look at what we're doing, what it looks like. Is it current? Is the style the way it should be? Is it reaching audiences? Asking those hard questions in whatever business you happen to be in, that makes a dramatic difference. But the key is stopping for a minute and thinking about, okay, how can I do this better? Where am I at right now? That's really critical.
I think this is a definitely a debatable point, but like, this is where I would go back to the book, what I'm, aiming for in June is, you're able to put your pride on the line and say, I'm not gonna be prideful of the last 15, 17 years. We need to reinvent ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have that open, you have to have that growth mindset and let go. Whereas somebody say, no, man, I'm it. I've arrived. Look at me.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't like my style, then it's not for you. We'll go find somebody who is like that. That kills most businesses. And
it does. I've met those guys, and they're not in the business anymore. Yeah. And must make a difference. And let me tell you, when you do focus on that and you see the change happen, I'll tell you, it's the most amazing thing in the world. I remember, and when you're in your lane, oh my gosh, the feeling is amazing. I remember years ago, I was filming in Italy, and we were working on a film, and it was in the middle of the night. It was like 3 a.m, and we're filming on a freezing cold hillside in Italy, pouring down rain, getting totally drenched. I'm on this hill. I've never been this cold in my life. And we're filming, and this thought hit me out of the blue that I'm having the time of my life. I was made to do.
I love it. Yeah.
So no matter how bad things get, if you're in your lane, if you're in your niche, man, it's a great feeling. And you're doing the right thing. It makes a real difference.
It's such a awesome point, because like even today, Phil, like I have 15 meetings today.
Whoa.
And instead of going, I have 15 meetings today, I'm going, man, I got 15 meetings today. Like, this is awesome. Like, I got purpose. We're profitable mentally, spiritually. I feel like we're financially, like things are going, like I am excited about my day today. Yeah. Like I could have zero meetings. I look at the three, I've, my boys are 19 and 21 years old, and they're starting to kind of get in that entrepreneur side of things.
Yeah.
And so I've been coaching them up on this, saying, there's vitamin C of business. You need clients, you need cash, and you need credit. If you don't have all three of those, is awesome, but you lose one of them.
Yeah.
Like no clients is not fun. Not being wanted is not fun. Not having cash is not fun. And so when all those things are aligning, it's a grind. You're important. Like enjoy and learn to love it. You know what I mean? Like that's exciting.
Well, and I'll tell you that what's even harder is we happen to live in the age of greatest change, particularly in our areas, marketing, media, that's ever been. I mean, I think of the legends in advertising and marketing back in the 60s who pretty much did the same thing for 10 or 20 years, and it was amazing. Whereas today, it seems like it changes every month. And we've got to constantly stay up on those kind of changes, or we're going to get left behind. So that's another reason why. I mean, I'm constantly looking around to seeing what are we doing? Is it competitive? Yeah. How does it compare to what other companies are doing? So important.
And like you used the word earlier, the compression rate of the change, like, oh my gosh, the AI, the video, the writing, all that, like if you're not embracing it, I think it's back to that book, Who Moved My Cheese, that book right there. Like you gotta move on, man. Like, I've been telling my designer, she's going to hear me say this, but like the way you designed in school, forget it. It's over.
True.
Like, just like if you want a job here, you need to get, like keep moving with what's happening out there. All right. Let's land a plane here. Okay. This has been awesome. I kind of want to just summarize what I got from this podcast, which is incredible. I think for me, just hearing you talk, the better you become at what you do, rises above the noise. That spoke loud to me today, Phil. Like, that is so encouraging. I'm so inspired by that message. That, and here's why. That's in, if you're listening, that's in your control. You can do that. You are choosing to be distracted. You can choose to be disciplined, to be accountable, to be persistent in what you love to do and what inspires you. Like, go be great at that, man. Like, that will rise above the noise. You don't have to, as a hockey player, I was not the most talented guy. I've played with guys that were talented. That was not me. I had to out hustle and outwork and show up early and come late. I figured that out and I said, I can do that.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't born with this talent. Like, I thought I was until I got around guys that were talented. And I thought, man, I got to come prepared. And that's it was inspiring to me because I can do that. Like, that's in my wheelhouse, you know?
Yeah.
So I would love
by the way, I would encourage people to expand what they think talent is. You may not be a creative writer or you may not be a brilliant leader or whatever, but I have a friend in Hollywood that discovered, man, he's no good at editing. He's no good at directing. He's no good at acting. He's none of those things, but he has the incredible talent of assembling an amazing team who is brilliant at all those things. And so he became a producer simply because he couldn't do all the individual things, but he could pull people together who could, and they've made some amazing films. So
that's awesome.
Expand what your idea of talent is, and that may open the door to a lot of people.
That's so beautiful. I mean, you're talking about a producer and somebody who can collaborate and put the right people in the room and not be the guy, like putting your fear, lust, anger, pride on the shelf and going, I'm not the guy, but here are the people in the room that are. Like, you're an asset if you're able to do that. It's connecting people. Like, that's, I love that, man.
That's good. That's good stuff.
For you, summarizing pain points from a pastoral or a Christian entrepreneur perspective, I'll leave you with a final thought.
Well, I think the important thing is lead with your skill, not your faith. For those Christians listening, I tell young directors all the time who are coming to Hollywood, don't lead with your testimony. Don't lead with your faith. Lead with your skill. Go out and be an amazing producer, an amazing writer, an incredible actor. Because once you've shown that and people see that, they'll listen to anything you have to say. I find young people all the time coming to Hollywood who decide, I'm going to change the industry. I'm going to talk about my faith. I'm going to talk about how God can change this industry. And they get laughed off the lot. They get laughed right out of the studio and they go back to Iowa with their tail between their legs. But then others come out who are just, they're upfront about how great a director they are, and they show it. They do it and they show it, and that gets people's attention. And once they have, you know, you have their attention, they don't care if you're a Christian, if you're a Buddhist, if you're a, you know, a Freemason, they don't care what you do. They just love the fact that you're brilliant. So your talent will open up doors that you could never dream about for sharing your faith with whatever industry you're in, be a great real estate agent or a great pastor, whatever. That opens doors up that you know, just leading with your faith won't do. So just be careful about how you engage a secular culture, particularly the one we live in today.
That's so good, Phil. Yeah. I mean, and that's not a popular message either, by the way. I can just see people going, all right, Phil, I'm not supposed to have faith.
Let me just say, just as a response, one of my close friends in LA directs cop shows.
Okay.
And he told me not long ago, he said, you know, when I've got a crew of about 60 people, we're filming cop shows every day of the week and you know, for networks. And he said, I've got about 60 people in my crew. He said, I've never said anything about being a Christian. I don't broadcast it. I don't make it a big deal. But he said, it's just interesting when somebody on my crew is going through an alcohol problem or a marriage problem, or maybe a kid problem with drugs or something, they always seem to find their way to me. And I think that's the power of the Holy Spirit, because he's a brilliant director. He's won everyone's respect. So then his faith draws people without even having to broadcast it. So that's, I think, the way it really needs to work. And that's the way you change an often hostile culture. You just make that kind of a difference with your skill, and suddenly they're willing to listen. So anyway, that's my sermon for today.
I love it. Thank you, Phil, for your time. You're awesome, man.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So good. Join us again next week as we continue to uncover the secrets to success with faith-based testimonies and the power of R7. Remember, destiny awaits, but time does not.